believe that the Oregon Forest Practices Act should apply to these plantation hybrid poplar trees. I would argue, and I don't know if I've stated this already on the record, that the current plantations of poplar that exist in Oregon, there are a couple of large blocks, one on the east side over near Boardman, one in Klatskanai, and then there are little pockets. Individual farmers have tried it out throughout the Willamette Valley, and they're largely in the Willamette Valley. They're largely planted on agricultural lands, and I would argue that if you plant a hybrid poplar tree farm in a cornfield, I don't really know that the Oregon Forest Practices Act was meant to regulate those type of activities. Some may say it should. I respectfully disagree. So I'm here to support this bill. I think it's necessary for the ongoing survival and growth of this industry. If you can't grow those trees for a longer period of time before they're harvested, you simply cannot put together an economical manufacturing operation that would move hybrid poplar as a species from wood chip production into solid wood products, whether it be veneer or solid sawn lumber. It can't be done. There's been a number of folks that have tried it. I myself in the past have looked at numerous models. It's just tough. If you can't get a larger piece size, you can't get the production through a mill to make it happen. So I really do think that this is a jobs issue. It's going to give folks with certain types of land other opportunities to diversify what they grow and what they do with their land. And I think it'd be good for Oregon. So after myself, you'll have folks coming up to testify about much more of the technical aspects of growing short rotational tree plantation wood, and also some of the specifics of the bill. So okay. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
To this point? Okay. All I want to say, the dash ones are really capturing the whole thing and embedding it as the new bill. Is that pretty much what the dash ones represent, I think, the bill that was originally...
I haven't seen the dash ones, to be honest.
Okay.
So, but I look forward to the opportunity.
See, you're in the dash ones. Okay, I'm pretty sure it is the other bill that was put into a form to be put into this one.
Actually, I do have a question for the representative, and I know we're going to hear from other folks after this, and I'm somewhat familiar with the use of hybrid poplars for dire mediation. It uses a technique, and that it's typically grown, you know, in areas that are fairly flat, sometimes subject to irrigation and not. But did you have a chance to listen to the legislative history about... I'm curious about the legislative intent of why this was originally exempted from the Forest Practices Act. I mean, I can take a guess in that it's grown more like an agricultural crop than a forestry crop, but if it's harvested, my question is, it's the harvesting and making sure that we're protecting stream buffers and that we're not jeopardizing water quality or streams that might be fish faring, and I guess I don't know if you've had a chance to either talk to folks who were there when this original legislation was passed or to look at the legislative history intent of exempting it from the Forest Practices Act, because that would help when I'm reading this and making a decision about whether we should keep the exemption or look at changes because of the longer rotational time that you're proposing.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I've spent time talking with folks from the industry that I haven't gone back and I haven't looked at any public records about testimony, and so I've I've talked with folks anecdotally. I don't know that I'm really, really well qualified, to be honest, to relay right here, right now, what that expressed intent was during during those hearings.
We do have some people who
I was going to say, you know, there may be, given the institutional memory in this building,
sure.
There may be some people that were at that hearing and could illuminate that for us.
Yep, I'm sure.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
You.
We have a number of people, actually more surprising to me than I thought, a number of people on this bill. And so we have talked to Representative Holvey, who is introducing the second bill. We're going to move that to Thursday. So we'll only have this bill and then go to the Cougars. So that works out better, just so we know how we're doing our timeline. So next we'll have, we'll just kind of go in the order that they signed up. It looks like Don Rice, Steve Strauss, and Bob Carl, all of them, if they want to come forward and take a seat.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Rice, and I'm the Oregon Poplar Resource Manager for Potlatch. I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address you here today in support of House Bill 3481. I also need to thank those legislators that have helped us get to this point, particularly Representative Edwards, Senator Nelson, and also the governor's office as well. Potlatch currently manages about 17,000 acres of poplar in Morrow County, Oregon. You may have heard that Potlatch has announced the pending sale of a poplar farm to an equity tree farm fund. The sale is in the closing process, and during that time period, we are continuing to operate as Potlatch. The legislation and the multiple market production strategy associated with it is even more important to the new owners who do not have pulp and paper affiliation. The farm currently employs about 50 people on a full-time basis and up to 200 seasonally through company and contractor activities. Potlatch began developing the farm in the early 1900s, as Representative Edwards had indicated, largely focused on supporting the pulp and paper industry. As the pulp market has made swings up and down over the years since then, the company made decisions about 1999-2000 to try and have multiple options available for the product, and have taken steps to get to that point. So for about the last year, the company has been engaged in product trials around veneer, solid wood markets, and those have been very successful, but have also shown, as Representative Edwards said, to really get the benefit, the trees need a little bit more size, which means a little bit more time. Oregon statutes define poplar as an agricultural crop if it meets the tests of agricultural sites, ag management, and a harvest cycle of 12 years or less. This bill proposes to only change the agricultural rotation part of the definition from 12 to 20. Currently, if the poplars are grown beyond the 12-year ag period, the Forest Practices Act would come into play. And there are some technical aspects of the Forest Practices Act that are hard to apply in an agricultural setting. Particularly leaving two standing trees per acre makes it difficult to conduct the farming practices. Leaving large dead wood in the field makes it hard to cultivate. And then particularly the statutory limitation on harvest size. The statutory limit is smaller than our irrigation blocks, and so our irrigation management would not be feasible with the smaller harvest sizes. And then there's also aspects of the green-up requirements of waiting 4 years before you would harvest an adjacent unit. And once again, with the irrigation design and the rapid growth of the trees, by the time 4 years goes by, the trees are going to be 40 to 45 feet tall. And so those are just inconsistent with the poplar farming aspects. In addition, this bill does address the subject of taxation. Property where poplar is grown is taxed as agriculture, was taxed prior to the poplar crop as agriculture, and in the future, when and if we rotate out of poplar, it would be taxed as agriculture for the crops that would be grown. If House Bill 3481 does not pass and the trees are grown beyond 12 years, the county would have to tax the property as forestry. As calculated by the Department of Revenue in Morrill County, if our farm were reclassified as forestry, the tax as a result of the change in valuation would go down from over $7 an acre to less than $1 an acre taxed as forestry special assessment. This would result for our farm in about $120,000 tax impact to the county. Additionally, the statute also references the forest products harvest tax. This is a tax that goes to help fund forest stewardship officers through the Forest Practices Act, OSU Conifer Forestry Research, and fire protection. The fire protection currently is provided by the Boardman Rural Fire Protection District. They're in the process of developing plans for a new substation in our area, and if they lost the tax support from us, that would impact their plans to develop fire protection, not just for our farm, but the adjoining farms as well. We currently do not lie in any forest fire protection district. Poplar is an amazing crop. It grows fast. It's versatile. It's grown on agricultural land, but it also presents its challenges. It requires intensive cultivation and other farming activities. Hence, poplar has been treated as an agricultural crop rather than forestry. Today, poplar growers in Oregon are pursuing multiple markets, such as veneer, moldings, panelings. These markets currently utilize imported radiata pine. It is good for the Oregon economy to produce a locally grown resource and manufacture it here and supply local markets that will not have to rely on imported wood for this volume. Poplar has been a focus for the biomass energy research for over 30 years and is in the position to be a significant part of biomass energy strategy for the state. Potlatch's poplar production is currently independently certified as sustainable under plantation standards, not forestry. Potlatch's poplar management is also certified under ISO 14001 standards. We have cooperative wildlife habitat management agreements with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Nature Conservancy. Poplar is grown in an agricultural production community, agricultural practices, and should be treated as an agricultural crop. I'd ask you to please support House Bill 3481.
Thank you. Questions now, or can we have the whole group?
Seven votes.
Okay. Is that Steve?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chair Roblin and members of the Natural Resource Committee. I'll just very briefly summarize that first paragraph in the letter that's before you. I'm a professor at OSU, and I've worked with the poplar industry for about 20 years. I've been to various meetings and tours around the world.
Give your name, too.
Oh, is that relevant?
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No
Steve
problem.
Strauss.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I'm the College of Forestry at Oregon State. Anyway, so I know the poplar industry fairly well, particularly from the biological side of growing and managing the plantations. So I think I bring a pretty global perspective to this issue. So I'm here to support this bill to increase the rotation age. I agree with what you just heard, that poplars really are fundamentally agricultural crops and how they're managed with well-defined nutrition, site management, and genetics. And as you also heard, it has a great potential for new markets, such as for bioenergy, biofuels, novel biomaterials, furniture, and moldings. The Department of Energy considers poplar their model woody energy crop because it grows rapidly in many parts of the USA, provides many environmental benefits, and it also can produce many kinds of products, as well as being amenable to advanced breeding methods guaranteeing future improvements. The DOE, if you read their literature, emphasizes a biorefinery approach to energy crops, including poplar, where they are bred, managed, and processed to provide a diverse array of products, of which energy is only one. I feel the increased flexibility provided by a longer rotation age fits well with this concept, as it will allow poplar growers to produce high-value solid wood products from large prune trees at the same time as they can be producing energy and other products from the thinnings, smaller sections of the stem, leaves, and branches. If you look around the world, hybrid poplars are frequently harvested at ages of 15 to 20 years. This is common in Europe and Asia. And many of these systems have been sustainably managed for decades to centuries. It seems to me a matter of common sense that Oregon should also give its poplar growers the flexibility they need to also produce the best, most diverse, and highest value products that they can. And it's for that simple reason that I encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you. Is Bob Carl there as well?
Mr. Chair, he signed up for the long bill.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Move
him over to the other one. Okay, any questions for this panel? Yes.
Just had one on this tax issue. The loss to, I don't know if it was a particular county you were describing or in general.
Morrow County.
That's because instead of paying, well, it'd go into farm deferral.
It's currently in farm deferral, and if it goes into forestry, it'd be going to forestry. It's in farm special assessments, that right. I believe the correct term. And if it goes beyond 12, then it wouldn't meet the definitions and would then go into forestry special assessment, which is a much lower valuation per acre at the same tax rate. So the total tax would decrease.
And I guess that's my question. Total tax to who? That's
county property tax is what I'm speaking of there.
So is there an accompanying increase because of the harvest tax to, let's say, the state and the forestry department? So, I mean, is $120,000 really the net loss, or is it that's the loss there?
There isn't a severance tax like there used to be years ago. It's all wrapped into the property tax unless you're in, I believe, there's other people here that can probably answer that. Small tract, special assessment, or something like that, is there still a severance, I believe. But in general, it's all in property tax now, as I understand it.
I don't think so.
There are a couple other
elements to that. I spoke relative to property tax. Some elements of the irrigation system might become or would become subject to personal property tax, which would narrow that a little bit, but the amount of decline in the property tax is not offset by the amount that would be collected on personal property tax. Mm-hmm. And the other tax I mentioned was the forest products harvest tax, which doesn't go to the state or the county. It goes to those specific applications, as I understand it.
Representative Dingfelder.
I didn't have a question. Oh, okay. It's for forestry, actually,
okay.
When they come
and
out.
And we can get them when they get here.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you both.
Okay. Thank you.
Or agriculture. Are we having both come and testify?
Pardon?
Is ODA here?
No. They haven't signed up. So the next one is, and there may be other people who signed up on the wrong sheet. We'll find out as we do this. So Walter Miller, Rob Miller.
Rob's right there.
And Jeff.
Not Rob.
Nuss. Okay.
Excuse me, Jeff.
And Paul Carton. Harlan, is that right? Paul? From Lake County? No, Sam. Well, we'll take.
He's here.
Okay. Speaker's office.
You're in trouble.
We're going to try to keep it as quick as you can so we can get this through. We have about a half hour, a little less for this, the rest of the session. So away we go.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nuss, and I'm the founder and president of Greenwood Resources. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today on this bill. Since the early 90s, I've had an opportunity, a fairly unique opportunity, to be part of these poplar tree farms you've seen in the Oregon landscape. Working for C.H. Tome Hill early in my professional career, I was given a chance to work on the Potlatch Corporation development poplar tree farm you see along Interstate 84, as well as be involved in many projects related to using poplar trees in environmental applications like you see at the City of Woodburn's beneficial reuse of wastewater and effluent project. It was during this time I began to see the amazing value of these tree farms and how they can bring that value to the agricultural landscape, the environment, the forest products industry, and rural communities. Although most of the commercially focused poplar tree farms were developed by forest products companies such as Crown Zellerbach, Boise Cascade, and Potlatch for sustainable supply of hardwood chips for pulp and paper mills, the state of Oregon and Oregon Economic Development Department in the mid-90s began to support a new vision for these types of tree farms through a study to assess the solid wood applications for the wood grown on these agricultural operations. This was the beginning of a significant opportunity for this state and for the agricultural and forestry industry combined. It was during this time that Greenwood Resources was founded with a vision to become a leader in the development and management of sustainable high-yield fast-growing tree farms. Poplar as a species is recognized as the fastest growing tree in the temperate zones in the world and presents a unique opportunity for the state of Oregon due to its history of research and commitment to growing this tree in the agricultural landscape. Since that time, Greenwood Resources has been successful in getting private equity capital to look at these tree farms as a new place to invest for their sustainable management and environmental principles, their support for rural communities, and their economic return on investments. We currently manage close to 16,000 acres of poplar farms in the lower and upper Columbia River on three different tree farms located both in Oregon and in Washington. We have been managing these tree farms on behalf of investors into tree farm investment funds and have been making significant capital investments managing these tree farms for multiple markets consisting of saw logs, for lumber and veneer, pulp logs for hardwood chips and residual for bioenergy and fuels. We have also been awarded a number of Department of Energy grants as well as a grant from Chevron focused on the future of biofuels and carbon sequestration values of these types of tree farms and how they can bring this value of our country and state's goals around renewable energy. All of these opportunities have given Greenwood Resources the opportunity to apply its unique expertise to investors, forest products companies, Native American tribes, municipalities, and other countries looking at the potential of these types of tree farms and how they can provide an environmentally sustainable supply of fiber for multiple markets and applications. This has created the opportunity for Greenwood to open offices and expand our operations in the Pacific Northwest as well as far-reaching as China and Chile. In all, we employ over 27 employees and nearly 100 seasonal employees through the contracting activities we do on our tree farms. Much like the early technology advances in agriculture related to improved plant material and yields for agricultural crops, we have significant focus in our business on continuously improving poplar tree farms we plant on our tree farms through traditional breeding techniques. These techniques help us improve growth and yield, site adaptability, resistance to insects and diseases, and wood properties for both forest products and energy markets. Most of this work is performed on a 120-acre tree improvement technology center and greenhouse nursery operation in Westport, Oregon. We are very excited about the future of the existing tree farms in Oregon and have come here today to ask for your support in ensuring these tree farms can reach their full potential and recognize the potential of these types of tree farms for Oregon's agriculture and forest products industry. As you have seen or will see in some of today's testimonies and ones still to come, we are not looking for reduced regulation but recognition that specific provisions of the Forest Practice Act do not apply to the way we are required to manage our tree farms on agricultural land in the production of the desired products, whether it's for pulpwood only or for multiple markets. This was the reason there was a law originally passed by Oregon legislators as well as Washington legislators. The rotation length has just been an evolution of the significance these tree farms can have for multiple markets. This evolution is a result of working with many forest products companies in Oregon and other western states that have come to realize the value of this wood in providing sustainable supply of hardwood logs for the industry. Some of these companies have come here today, and others are providing their support through letters already submitted and ones still to come. It is through this mutual support and interest in both agriculture and forestry communities that encourage me in the value of what we're doing. It should be noted that these companies and individuals providing their support cover a wide range of leaders, from forest and agricultural land managers, local and county governments, port operations, forest products, manufacturing operations, and research. I'm sure, as in many things, there is rarely a unanimous agreement by all parties. However, I believe you will find, as you come to understand the realities of what we are doing at these tree farms, both on the west side and the east side, the level of support represented from many different interests and industries, both publicly and privately, and the true need for this improvement to the existing laws, my hope is that you'll see the value of the support of this bill. The existing law is a good law, and the bill is good policy resulting in the needed improvement to the law. It's good for agricultural interests, forestry interests, environmental interests, rural communities, counties, land management stewards, universities, and the future of the state. I would encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to have to limit people because we're running closer on time. So just a couple minutes each, and then we've got some people who are against, but I need to get them some time as well. So yes.
I'll go next, and I'll be very brief.
Okay. Thank you.
I am Walter R. Miller, but I go by Rob. I am the president of Mount Jefferson Farms, Inc., Miller Forest, Inc., and some other companies that I won't go into. We've been growing poplar for almost 40 years. We're on the west side. We're a relatively small grower, but one of the oldest growers in the industry. I just want to basically let folks know that there's a place for a smaller grower here. The opportunity on the west side is immense. In our own case, if the bill was implemented as written, we would plant more trees. We would plant trees for energy as well as for solid wood products. We're well versed in that industry already. We would combine it with a straw facility, perhaps. It would allow us to take that next step with a cellulose straw and wood products for energy. We believe very, very strongly, having been on a lot of state boards that have looked at strategic opportunities for Oregon, that this is probably one of the best ones that's ever come along. If one looks at the Oregon Inc. proposals, the Sustainability Board proposals, Oregon Innovation Council proposals, the Sun Grant proposals, all of these, right down to specific strategic centers like the BEST Center, all have as their foremost statement energy independence. There is nothing really better in Oregon that I know of, other than perhaps straw in some ways, that can possibly produce the energy that Oregon needs. As an example, if you were to take all of the residual that comes off of the 40,000 acres that are currently in poplars, it would meet a stated goal on one of the governor's publications for 2008, which is 5 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol. Gives you a flavor of what just the poplar in production do now. I would basically, in order to close and save some time, say that we need to look at this as an Oregon opportunity as well as a business opportunity for small growers and large ones alike. And it can be done very successfully on the west side, but we can't produce these trees here, and I've been doing this for 40 years in less than 16 to 20 acres, or 20 years.
Thank you very much.
Chairman, committee members, I'm Paul Harlan, Vice President of Resources for Collins Pine Company. I live and reside in Lakeview, also the a current board member of the Forest Stewardship Council U.S. and a past chair of that organization. I want to talk just quickly about economic gains for the state, which is always important, especially in rural communities. In the late 90s, I was operating the sawmill, managing the mill in Lakeview, and we ran a test in conjunction with Potlatch to take a look at trying to extend the rotations to try to look at producing higher-valued products instead of the commodity products of chips. This past winter in December, Collins also was involved, and I was involved in, again, running a test of 11-year-old trees off the poplar plantations out of Boardman, and to look at those results. And I'm here to tell you that this concept of being able to add value for rural communities is right on the verge of happening, but that's where this bill is important, to give that additional time for those trees to add that value onto that. It's very important. I want to talk a little bit about adding value in our communities, since that having worked for Collins and Lakeview now for 21 years and watching the decline of the Eastern Oregon timber industry and looking at the impacts of the remanufacturing facilities that we have in Oregon, is tremendous. We now have a mill next to ours in Lakeview that imports all of their radiata pine lumber from South America and New Zealand into Lakeview. It's not the way we should be doing business. They need a sure supply. This type of action, if the rotation is extended, can allow companies like that now to go back and use locally produced and grown materials in their facilities to produce jobs in Oregon and to keep that by adding value. And I think everyone in the state, that's something that we all should be looking for. It also helps diversify the economy. We're taking a commodity product and adding value to that, and I very few people will find difficulty with that concept. And finally, if we are worried about energy production, look at the energy production to move raw materials to our manufacturing plants in Oregon from New Zealand and Chile, compared to producing it right here in Oregon. So we are, Collins is in favor of House Bill 3481, and especially the extension of the rotation age. It is this concept of being able to add value is right on the cusp, and it's extremely important. The prior gentleman has talked about of adding that into it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Yes.
Two quick questions for anybody who wants to answer this. One is, how many acres of hybrid poplar in production statewide, number one, and then two, is it 100% irrigated? And if you could just sort of talk a little bit about the amount of irrigation that's used for growing hybrid poplars versus another agricultural crop that might be grown in the same area.
I could take a Representative Digfelder. I can take a quick answer at that. Correct me if somebody disagrees. I off the cuff, probably 90%. And this is just my opinion of the poplar is grown with irrigation. There is some that is grown without it, but it's not grown at an economical pace. That's the problem. It's probably almost doubles the growth period. 40,000 acres, approximately, are the number of acres in hybrid poplar
statewide.
And as far as irrigation efficiency, Potlatch would be a perfect one to ask that question because of the state-of-the-art technology, satellite technology, Water Resources Department work they've done. We use absolutely state-of-the-art technology here. Everything is metered. We have the best equipment that we possibly can use, and I would say we have probably gained 30 to 50% in irrigation efficiency just off the top of my head in the 20 to 30 years that I've been involved with irrigating hybrid poplars. I could give you the amount per acre, but it would vary on the soil, probably 12 inches to maybe as high as 18 inches and maybe 10% both ways of that on an irrigated acre.
Thanks.
Just to add to that, just briefly, because I was involved in the Potlatch Project, from the standpoint of its water use comparable to its previous crop that it had, when it was converted, there was no change in its water consumption. And the efficiencies of which was able to be captured because of the intensity of the high technology that was applied was significant. Saved a lot of water and saved actually a lot of power. And we manage, for your point, we manage two irrigated farms on the east side, and we manage a farm on the west side that was the oldest poplar tree farm in North America. It was developed by Crown Zeller back. And it also is, in essence, irrigated. It's done through a different type of system. It's done through a drainage district / irrigation system where it still has pumps, pipelines, and canal ditches to control the amount of water that can be applied and allow the type of environment that's needed for the trees to grow. And I would confirm Rob's point about over 90% probably is irrigated in ag, whether it's on the east side or west side.
We are also growing other crops, Representative Dingfelder, under poplar through agroforestry. So a lot of times we're double irrigating both a nursery crop, food crop. We're doing some organic work. And I'm not sure exactly how you would factor that in, but every one of those acres probably cuts that water use to the trees maybe in half. Really exciting field.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Oh, Mike? Is it Godrin? OSWA, Barry Bashu, and Patty. And if we have to, we'll carry this one over because I'm going to have an hour for the other meeting, so.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you very much indeed for allowing us to testify in absolute opposition to this bill. We have met on numerous occasions amongst the Oregon Small... my name is Mike Gedern, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We are an association of family woodland owners across the entire state, east side, west side, north and south. We have talked a number of occasions about this bill and about poplar in particular, extending the rotation length from 12 to 20 years. Our opposition is based on many issues, but due to the time constraints, I'd like to focus on just two today. The bad precedent that is set by focusing on a single species within the forestry sector is, we think, terrible. Because what is next? As one of our members said this morning, does Douglas fir come next? Where does this stop? So in terms of protecting Oregon forest resources for public good and benefits, we believe in a strong Forest Practices Act that applies to all products that enter the sawn wood market. And that is a fundamental problem here. We are now going to see poplar plantation trees and their products entering marketplaces that will compete with our logs and markets, whether they're alder or Doug fir. So we have a major problem with basically having one rule for one and one rule for another. It would be like having two cars, and one car has to abide by emission standards and abide by safety standards, and the other car doesn't. As you're driving down the road, and you're passed by the car that doesn't, and you're in the car that does, you're going to be rather upset. And that's where many of our members are. We're also concerned about what this does to the Forest Practices Act in terms of dilution of revenue. We have heard that there is no revenue problems with the harvest tax. There is. OSU, extension agents, forest practices research, our forest practices stewardship forests will be affected if we see this revenue in terms of harvest tax exempt. So those are the two issues that we have major problems with. We are more than happy to follow up the members of the committee in the future regarding this bill. Thank you.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, my name is Barry Bashu. I'm the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation and farm near Gresham, Oregon. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to House Bill 3481. As you are aware, Oregon agriculture is very diverse, and many of our members are also timber landowners and operators. In the past, Oregon Farm Bureau has been supportive of legislation to exempt poplar operations producing products for pulp and paper from the Forest Products Harvest Tax and the Forest Practices Act. We recognize the unique nature of their production systems. However, we oppose these same exemptions being extended beyond the current 12-year time frame. At a 20-year rotation, poplar operators will be able to grow larger trees and market those trees for solid wood products and veneer for plywood. These are similar markets that our small woodlot owners are selling into. Our membership views these operations as hardwood timber based on their appearance and end uses. They also believe the poplar industry should share the same regulatory and tax burden as other forest lands. I heard earlier in testimony the discussion about this being on ag land. Nobody is more interested in preserving ag land than the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. However, I would point out that in this instance, once a tree becomes 20 years, it's no longer an agricultural product, it's timber. and an operation of this size with trees of this size going in direct competition, they should be brought into the Forest Practices Act. A lot of political blood was spilt over a large number of years to establish these Forest Practices Acts. They need to be supported and supported fully by those people that are actually raising timber. And I think this would digress from that and, as this gentleman said, divert from it. We agree that compliance with the Forest Practices Act and the harvest tax are costly. We also recognize that the plantation and irrigation practices are unique to the poplar sector. However, a blanket exemption is not the answer. We must all make management and business decisions within the guidelines of the law. Passage of HB 3481 would give production advantages to the poplar industry that are not available to other sectors of the timber industry. And I'll be happy to take any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm confused about the financial impact, harvest tax versus not a harvest tax. And in order to go forward, I'm going to need a lot more information on that impact.
Okay. Any answers to whether there is a harvest tax or a non-harvest tax? Yeah.
As far as we can tell, there's a harvest tax when you're selling forest products.
Okay.
We've been paying it for quite a few years, and they're happy to do so. We could follow up with the Department of Revenue and give you the fiscal impact.
Well, we'll find that.
I'm looking at the comparison between the property tax and the harvest tax.
No comparison. We'll work on a comparison. Thanks. Any other questions?
I just have one question. I think it's in general. I mean, I've heard you say, or maybe it was Barry, but somebody up there said that you understand there are some differences. And I'm thinking about, you know, the two trees or however many trees are left in a you know, in a clear cut, and I think about harvesting something, you know, like a giant corn stalk, basically, and leaving two poplars. I don't know if that makes sense. You know, it doesn't mean you change the whole thing, but are you open to having those kind of conversations? That are there some things that don't make sense, or I mean, is the position that it's going to have to be the exact same law, even if it doesn't make sense, we'll, you know, that 10% of the time it doesn't or whatever, we'll just have to live with it.
Representative Clem, we have talked about that particular issue, especially on the east side, and we've been talking about it for some time now. We think that to have the Forest Practices Act diluted in any way would severely affect our social license to practice forestry. And to hear that these products are green forest certified products, it really needs to be on a level playing field with the rest of the forest products industry. So whilst we understand that, I mean, plantation forestry of Douglas fir, you could argue the same potential for that particular tree species, and that's why we think based on the tree species this is a bad idea. If you're going to do that across the board, are we going to have Douglas fir plantations exempt from the Forest Practices Act? We say no.
Okay. Representative Dingfelder.
Well, I'm just looking at the statute, and the existing statute calls out, I'm not trying to be argumentative here, but it already does say that land used for the purposes of growing hardwood timber, including but not limited to hybrid cottonwood, if. So my understanding is that that's already in statute. What they're proposing is under subsection C, where it's changing it from 12 to 20 years. So it already is in statute for a specific
tree species.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so
what we
the way I'm reading this, you're opposed to this whole part of the statute.
What we could potentially see is, as you've heard from me before, the forest landowners have choices. A choice could be that forest landowners, having seen this particular tree species exempt from the Forest Practices Act, mm-hmm. you'd suddenly see an explosion of hybrid poplar in western and eastern Oregon. Mm-hmm. Is that really what we want to see from this state? We would say that many of our landowners are growing Douglas fir and other native species well and for a variety of benefits that include all the benefits you heard from poplar, and you could swap any of the names of those trees out from poplar and replace it with the tree species that we grow currently.
So just to follow up, and I think this may be where Representative Boquist, so Christmas trees, for instance, what's the rotational harvest on that, and is that subject to the Forest Practices Act?
Christmas trees, as far as I understand, are classed as a agricultural product, and I would defer to my friend from the Farm Bureau on that one.
Representative Dingfelder, Chairman Roblin, I believe that Christmas trees are exempt because they are considerably less time, probably 8 years. Mm-hmm. A 10-year-old Christmas tree is pretty hard to sell.
And so that's not subject to the Forest Practices Act?
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think
just one more. I know we've no. All right, sir. Yes.
Thank you both. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Had a case we called before, maybe on the other bill, or no? Larry Dolly.
Mr. Chairman, in support of the bill, my testimony will repeat whatever
okay.
If I can drop it off with staff.
We would love it. That would be great. Thank you. Here, Corey Boswell. And then the last one is Ray Wilkerson.
There you go. Do you want to see the statute? I'm sure you're going to read it.
So they did make it. I keep forgetting they're outside. There's people all around. And again, we'll try to keep this fairly close to a couple minutes each. And if go ahead.
Chairman Robin and members of the committee, my name is Corey Boswell. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian from Owyhee County. Currently live in the Portland area and work for Greenwood Resources. A couple of things that have not been talked about yet. I work on a day-to-day basis with the managers of our tree farms, and I want to talk a little bit about the practices that we use. Before we grew trees on our fields produced agricultural crops, mint, hay, wheat, potatoes, berries, pasture. And they're agricultural soils. They're primarily sandy loam, silt loam type soils. The slopes are primarily less than 3%. These are very, very definitely agricultural sites. After we harvest, we'll make somewhere between 10 and 15 tractor passes over each one of these fields. And just in order to mulch the harvest debris, to prepare the site for planting, to control weeds. We monitor everything very closely. We try and provide the trees exactly as much moisture as they need. We also monitor for nitrogen levels and other fertilizer that we might apply based on the needs of the crop. So these are obviously agricultural practices. And again, the statutory requirements of the Forest Practices Act would be completely inconsistent with this type of an operation. And that's pretty clear on a just a practical basis as you look at it. Finally, just in one more practical point, when people ask what I do, I ask them if they've seen the trees growing along the interstate near Boardman and along the Highway 30 to Clatskanie. And I've never been once been, the response has never been, oh, so you're in forestry. This is very clearly agriculture. And Oregon's laws should make that distinction and treat these trees accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'll try to be quick. I do have written testimony. I think the most important thing is to be clear about what this bill does and what it doesn't do. It certainly does not prevent people from growing their trees as long as they want to. The only question is, once you get past a certain point, should the Forest Practices Act apply or not? And in our view, that's an important question, and the burden of proof needs to be on the proponents of that proposal to establish that their activities are sufficiently distinctive from what other people in the industry do to justify different treatment. The Forest Practices Act, in our mind, is one of Oregon's most important, oldest and most important environmental laws. It has substantial requirements. It carries with it substantial costs. Those are costs and requirements that we accept. It gives us a social license to manage. It maintains public credibility in what we do, which unfortunately is controversial. Forest practices are just by nature controversial. So having this law on the books to give the public confidence that their resources are being protected is important to us to be able to manage going into the future. So making exemptions or exceptions to that law, I think, is a very ought to be a very steep hurdle for anybody to be able to get across. Is there a compelling justification or rationale to treat this type part of the industry different from the rest of us? We have met numerous times with the proponents of this bill during the session. Frankly, in our mind, they haven't met that test. We don't believe that their activities are that sufficiently different. Every business in America would like lower taxes and less regulation. That's just the nature of it, and that's what this bill would do in this situation. But the question is, it justified or not? Reference to agriculture, this is an agriculture activity. Really, that's what we do now, too. We used to mine old-growth timber when the timber industry first started. Now we grow trees as a crop, just like farmers grow trees as a crop just like the poplar growers do. It's basically the same types of activities, the types of practices that we do that are very much like agriculture. That's the reason the legislature abolished the severance tax here several sessions ago, because they were convinced that we're, you know, basically an agriculture enterprise and ought to be taxed like agriculture. So, you know, we could make the same argument that we're agriculture now and the Forest Practices Act shouldn't apply, but we don't make that argument, and we believe it should apply equally to all people who are generally speaking engaged in similar practices, which we think these folks are. You know, their products now, what they're wanting to go into is very similar to what we do. There's the similarities are much more numerous than the differences. And so, again, it's a slippery slope to go down to start talking about exemptions and exceptions to the Forest Practices Act, in our view. And we don't think that they've met that test here. One final comment. It was my testimony is exclusively related to the Forest Practices Act. It was my understanding from previous conversations with the proponents that they were no longer asking for an exemption from the Forest Products Harvest Tax. Based on what I've heard this afternoon, I may be mistaken about that, and if I'd known that, I would have addressed that issue, too, in the testimony, but that may be a misperception. But anyway, particularly on the Forest Practices Act, we think this is the burden of proof is high, and it hasn't been met in this case. So thank you.
Any questions? We'll probably get some more as time goes on from everybody on this issue, and I think that what this has done is will percolate in all of us as we consider this in the future. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to close our hearing on House Bill 3481. Do we know who the panel is? Okay, we're going to, and that one is 2971. We're going to open a public hearing on 2971. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator, and then we defer to representatives first, and there's a Representative Buckley in the deal. So you can start moving forward if you want while we have an explanation.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2971 would allow the Department of Fish and Wildlife to appoint persons to act as agents for the purpose of using one or more dogs to hunt or pursue black bear or cougar. The bill directs ODF&W to fix compensation and prescribe duties of agents.
Not on the paper right now.
For hearing, okay. You just need one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. For hearing, we can. Holy hearing.
Mm-hmm. You can. The bill further limits the authority of agents to act by terms set forth in the written appointment. There is no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact, but we have not yet received a statement.
Okay. Representative Buckley. She's going to go. Okay, again, now.
No, that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County, House District 5. Thank you for giving me a chance to weigh in on House Bill 2971. I'm going to start off by saying that my district voted in support of Measure 18, and I do not support House Bill 2971 for two reasons. First, because I believe it violates Measure 18, and secondly, because I don't think it's necessary. Now, Measure 18 did not affect the way that damage to livestock, property, or public safety issues are handled in our state. Current law allows for dogs and bait for these purposes. House Bill 2971 is not primarily about providing assistance to ranchers or to the public. The department has, since 1999, when the AG's office indicated a need for further authority to use agents, to create a means of providing that assistance. The reason that House Bill 2971 was created this particular time, 8 years later, is to implement the Cougar Management Plan and provide free administrative removal or killing. House Bill 2971 violates the intent and the spirit of Measure 18 to protect bears and cougars from unethical harassment, from unfair chase pursuit with hounds, and luring them into close range with gut piles and food. These tactics were deemed objectionable when used for fun, but are allowed solely for protection from imminent danger and damage. Now, there are instances where hounds are appropriate. Hounds are useful to target a specific animal. Hence, they may be appropriate in rare situations to remove a specific animal posing a threat. House Bill 2971 is not directed to this type of use, but allows for indiscriminate removal of animals that have not caused any problem. Experts believe that in those rare instances of damage or threat, that professionals, not appointed agents, should be called in to remove that one animal. They find no evidence that hunting or even culling will reduce conflicts. Now, last month, my county state employees killed three cougars outside of permitted boundaries from the plan. Three cougars killed outside of permitted boundaries. So I question why we would bring House Bill 2971 into play to allow even further latitude to state managers when trained personnel are making mistakes. Now, I drafted a Dash 1 amendment for your consideration that specifies clearly the approved use of bait and hounds in keeping with Measure 18. Now, House Bill 2971 gives broad authority to the state to deputize any person and allow them to be exempt from Measure 18 to assist the state, and I just do not believe this is a necessary move for us to make. The number of cougars killed in Oregon has more than doubled since passage of Measure 18. Additional cougars are being killed above sport and non-hunt mortality by the Cougar Management Plan. There's no need to allow further means of killing even more cougars, and I cannot support circumventing protections to enable further mortality. Now, whether you agree with the Cougar Management Plan or not, and that has been debated quite heavily, the plan does have a budget for its implementation. Now, I do not think we should go behind the voters' back to save money for the plan. To me, it's no different than anything else we do in state government. I sit on the education committee. We talk about how important it is to teach our kids. We don't just open the doors to let anybody come in because they say they can teach our kids. What we need to do with our expenditure of state money for the good of our state is to do it right. When we spend money or when we put a program into a place, it's our job to do with efficiency and with accountability. So I ask you to not pass on House Bill 2971, or if you feel you must, to at least use the Dash 1 amendments provided. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to answer any questions I'm capable of answering.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your consideration and your courtesy.
So we have a couple panels, and the first one, and I will invite Al Elkins. And who is coming with you, Al? From the Oregon Hunters Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. First of all, I'd like to thank you and the committee, Mr. Chair, for introducing this bill for us. We greatly appreciate that. I have some brilliant testimony written here that I was going to read, but for the sake of time, I will not do that. I'll basically outline what I wanted to say. Prior to 1999, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife used agents to assist with handling bears and cougars. In 1999, the Department of Justice issued an opinion that said that they did not have the specific authority to hire agents. In doing that, ODF&W lost the flexibility to utilize agents in dealing with specific landowner damage complaints and to conduct cougar management. What House Bill 2971 does, and simply does, is gives the Department of Fish and Wildlife the authority to appoint agents. It specifies agent appointment in written form, and it requires ODF&W to prescribe the duties and conditions of the agent. What House Bill 2971 does not do is the bill does not expand ODF&W's authority to harvest cougars and bears. It allows, and it does not allow ODF, what it does do is it allows them to hire agents to provide services they currently are allowed to perform. In closing, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to say that currently under 4981642, which is the ballot measure from 94 language, that language currently in statute gives the Department of Fish and Wildlife the ability to use agents, but it does not clearly grant the department to designate such agents. House Bill 2971 gives them the authority to designate those agents, and that's why we introduced the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I guess we'll hear from the panel first, and then
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Rick Williams. I'm a native Oregonian, lifelong sportsman, and vice president of the Oregon Hunters Association. I have a short prepared statement. This legislation isn't about the Oregon State Fish and Wildlife Commission's authority to manage cougars. That fact is clearly outlined in Section 496 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. It also isn't about determining how many cougars should be administratively removed, or what method should be used. Those decisions have already been made by the Oregon State Fish and Wildlife Commission and are outlined in the Cougar Management Plan, Oregon Administrative Rule 635, Division 180. In accordance with the rulemaking process, facts were gathered, public testimony was heard, and the resulting Cougar Management Plan was adopted by the Commission on April 13, 2006. Consequently, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife was tasked with implementing the Cougar Management Plan in accordance with state law. What this legislation does address is who will be allowed to conduct the administrative removal of cougars for the Department of Fish and Wildlife in accordance with the approved Cougar Management Plan. The ODFW routinely utilizes volunteer labor in the form of agents in many other areas. The Hunter Education Program, Salmon Trout Enhancement Program, Fish and Wildlife Host Program, and the Becoming an Outdoors Woman Program all utilize volunteer agents that act at the behest and under the control of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. These volunteers annually contribute over 200,000 hours of labor to the ODFW's bottom line, and similar programs exist in many other state agencies. Hunters and non-hunters alike should easily recognize that the utilization of volunteer agents for the administrative cougar management would decrease the amount of budget funds that would need to be diverted from other important wildlife management programs to pay for what the ODFW could get for free. The ODFW utilized private agents for the management of cougars related to both human health and safety issues and private damage complaints from the time Measure 18 was passed in 1994 until 1999. At that time, the Oregon Attorney General's Office issued an interpretation of the law, ORS 498.164, which questioned the ODFW's authority to designate private individuals as agents for the purpose of cougar management. However, private landowners were not impacted by that decision and continue to utilize private agents to this day. The Oregon Cougar Management Plan was designed to use federal agents, ODFW employees, and/or the designated agents of the ODFW for the administrative management of cougars. However, the Attorney General's interpretation of ORS 498.164 currently does not allow private individuals to be used as the department's designated agent or agents, which negatively impacts the ODFW budget in excess of $100,000 during this year's initial phase alone. Bow Measure 18 was written expressly to ban sport hunting of cougars and bears by utilizing either dogs or bait. It did not ban cougar hunting or bear hunting in general and was never intended to hinder the ability of either the ODFW or private landowners to manage cougars. In fact, both of those entities were specifically exempted from the law, and a provision was included for them to use designated agents in their stead. Finally, it's important to note that this legislation does not circumvent the intent of Measure 18, as some would have you believe. It simply clarifies the scope of the department's use of agents. Administrative management of wildlife populations is vastly different than sport hunting, and the cougars will be removed by someone. It would be in the best interest of all Oregonians and the state's wildlife resources to ensure that the task is performed in the most efficient and economically sound way. I would urge you to support HB 2971 for all these reasons. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair of Committee, I'm Joe Ricker, Midwest Director, Oregon Hunters Association. I'm going to cut my four or five paragraphs down to about two after listening to my colleagues. You're going to hear this afternoon a lot of rhetoric on what this bill does and does not do. The fact is, it lets ODFW appoint volunteers as their agents to conduct administrative removal of cougars. The removal of cougars for management is clearly established by the Cougar Management Plan. I'll skip the next two paragraphs and just say, in summary, I support House Bill 2971, as it is a common sense thing to do. It saves money from the ODFW budget to manage wildlife. It allows ODFW to appoint non-paid volunteer agents to take cougars and does not violate Measure 18 or ballot Measure 18 and does not circumvent the intent of Measure 18. As my colleague has already stated, ballot Measure 18 was written expressly to ban sport hunting of cougars and bears by utilizing dogs and bait. House Bill 2971 allows ODFW to use agents for the purpose of administrative management of wildlife populations by taking cougars. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? None right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to have ODFW come on up, and then we'll have a panel against.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have a short prepared statement. On my right, Mr. Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On his right, Mr. Bill Cook, Department of Justice and longtime counsel, close counsel for us on wildlife legal issues from the Department of Justice. To the bill, Mr. Chair, and I know there's a lot of people here to testify, and I will keep it short. 4 points, again, and I think you've heard a little bit already from OHA. This bill does not accommodate recreational hunters by giving them an additional method, an opportunity to take cougars. The bill does not do that. What the bill does is allows the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to have the authority to designate agents to assist in wildlife management issues with the department on bear and cougar. And I'll let Mr. Anglin speak specifically about some of the problems we've had since 99 and why this bill was brought forward by the hunters. The benefits to the department will be an increase in effectiveness and efficiency in completing tasks related to the management of bears and cougars and the ability to designate owners of trained dogs to assist with this management. And then lastly, I know there are some amendments as to the dash twos. The addition of this language would provide a better distinction between agents acting in official capacity on the department's behalf versus the use of dogs in a recreational sport hunting situation. Appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today, and thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. I'd like to give you a couple examples of where we have run into problems with the definition relating to agent and our express authority to whether that we cannot use them. In the past, we have used houndsmen with dogs as part of our research projects, helping us capture cats and hang radio collars on them. We've contracted with those folks in order to conduct that work. Since the Attorney General's ruling that we received back in 2000, we have no longer been able to do that, and now we have to contract with the dogs and use the dogs ourselves. So we are in effect renting dogs from somebody else and using them now. And if you can imagine trying to get your own dogs to do something, imagine trying to do that with somebody else's dogs. The second way that we have run into problems since the determination by the Attorney General's office is in responding to specific bear and cougar damage complaints. In the past, we used to utilize volunteers at the local level. A lot of districts do not have wildlife services present within their county, so we rely on volunteers and houndsmen, and even where there is wildlife services, sometimes they don't have dogs available, and we would use those volunteers to help us solve specific problems. We can no longer do that. And yes, the landowner can, but there is a very important distinction to be made there in that the landowner, by statute, is confined to running dogs on their own property. The department is not constrained in that same manner. We can cross off of those property boundaries so long as we have permission to trespass on the adjacent property. So a landowner starts a cat off of a kill on their property. They get to the property boundary. They have to pull the dogs off and quit the chase. The department, if we had permission to trespass and our agent was doing the work, would not be bound by that same constraint. And then you've already heard the example that some people have raised relative to implementation of portions of the cougar management plan and the ability, where appropriate, to utilize agents during that implementation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm just going to address the legal basics of the agent issue, if I could. Legally speaking, appointing an agent is a fairly significant thing. An agent is more than just a volunteer. An agent is a fiduciary that you send out to do some act, an official act, on your behalf. They owe you a duty of loyalty. They can incur liability on your behalf, so they would be covered by the Oregon Tort Claims Act. It was because of these legally significant consequences that the Department of Justice said, if this is something you want to do, then you need to have specific authority to appoint agents. If you look at the Baron-Cougar statute, what it essentially says is, if you have authority to appoint agents, you may use them, you may allow them to use dogs. So they need authority in the first place to appoint the agent.
Questions? Would you say that the bill as in the amendments, could be the Dash 2s, does give that authority appropriately?
Chair Roblin, yes. The Dash 2 amendments accomplish that.
Okay. Any other questions for this group? Okay. Thank you very much. The next group, I hope I get this right, Noah Greenwald, Sally Mackler, Jim Ince, and Mike Moss. And thank you for being here.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and committee members. My name is Sally Mackler. I'm the wildlife chair for the Sierra Club. I'm representing our 24,000 members in Oregon and asking you to oppose HB 2971 for a variety of reasons. First of all, we are opposing the bill because we don't believe it is necessary in order to provide assistance to ranchers and the public that are in need in the rare event of a conflict. We believe that that would be covered underneath Mr. Buckley's amendment, which is why we support that amendment, which was given in the spirit of Measure 18. That's another reason why we disagree with his amendment, with this bill, because we believe it violates the intent and the spirit of Measure 18. And we are also opposing the bill because we believe it gives particularly broad authority to the department, enabling them to have volunteer agents potentially. It's not clear from the wording of the bill exactly who the agent will be, but we are assuming that they would be hunters, to have very, very broad authority to act as an official of the state to go out and be exempt from the ban on bait and hounds. And we do not believe that this is appropriate. We believe that the Cougar Management Plan is quite different than helping the individual rancher who happens to have an occasional problem. Quite different is the difference between indiscriminate and discriminate killing of bears and cougars with the use of a practice that the public decided was unethical and only allowed specifically for the use to pursue a particular individual problem animal that had a history of causing a problem. The way this bill is written, it allows the use of dogs and bait by a potential volunteer agent to go out and indiscriminately kill cougars, as the Cougar Management Plan indicates. I don't know how familiar you are with the Cougar Management Plan, but in order to really make a decision on this bill, you need to be familiar with Measure 18 and the Cougar Management Plan. We have a panel here of folks who will help to get you up to speed on both of those issues. We have Noah Greenwald, who is a conservation scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity in Portland. Jim Ince is a rancher for more than two decades in the area of the state which has the highest density of cougars in the state and potentially in the Pacific Northwest. And also we have Mike Moss, who is a rancher from Southern Oregon, rural Applegate Valley, who's also prepared to speak. I want to address the issue of discriminate versus indiscriminate, because I think this is an extremely important distinction that the committee needs to understand, and that involves some understanding of both Measure 18 and the Cougar Management Plan. The people that the public who voted for Measure 18 found these practices to be extreme and found that chasing down with packs of dogs to exhaustion, bears and cougars, to get them up into a tree to shoot them at short range was something that was unethical and unsporting, and they wanted to see this used strictly and only to assist property owners for the rare occasion when they have a problem cougar, and also to protect the public for incidents of threat for safety purposes. That's what hounds are for. They are particularly designed to pick up the scent of one animal, specific animal, find that animal, and make it easy for its removal. And that was the intent of Measure 18. This bill is extremely broad. It would allow we don't know whom to have this ability to use these animals for the Cougar Management Plan. The Cougar Management Plan was extremely controversial. It was opposed roundly by the public. Hundreds, if not thousands, of comments poured in, most of them opposing the plan, and significantly many of those comments were from peer review by scientists who were experts in the field of cougar biology and management. There were problems with the population model that they found, and Noah may be able to address that more than I'm going to be prepared to do so. There were problems with the single focus on killing in the plan. That is basically the only activity that the plan designates is killing cougars. There's not an educational component, particularly. There's no funding for an educational component. There's no description of a particular educational component beyond what's presently available, which is very minimal. There's no conservation component to the plan either. It is strictly a single focus killing plan, which many of the scientists disagreed with. In addition, the animals that are being targeted in a very specific way in certain areas called target zones or target areas. The way these areas are delineated is by looking at a history of 12 years of complaints from the public. Complaints from the public are roundly criticized by biologists as a means of assessing the presence of cougars or the trends in the population biology of cougars. I personally have reviewed those complaints in my district, and I have found them to go from legitimate to absolutely absurd. Little old ladies claiming their cats are missing and they're sure the cougars ate them that's a complaint. Those complaints are used to delineate where these cougars will be killed. In addition to that, cougars that were killed because they did damage is the other criteria that is being used to determine these areas. In these instances, these cougars have already been killed. The problem animal has been taken out by the individual rancher who found the problem, tracked the cougar, and removed it. So for all intent purposes, in these areas, which are using 12 years of information based on complaints and dead cougars, those cougars that caused the problems are long dead now. The animals that are being taken in that area are any animal that happens to be present in that animal and in that area, and that animal is killed. This is not a discriminant use of bait or hounds. In addition to that, as Representative Buckley pointed out, we are already removing far more cougars than we ever did in Oregon's history, more than double the number of cougars that were taken in 1994 and prior have been removed from the population today. And in terms of the economics of this, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has made quite a bit of money off cougar tags. Certain strategies were changed over the last 12 years to enable an increased take of cougar. Amongst them was reducing the price of the cougar tag, and as a result we have, and in your packet you will see that, there is an extreme number of cougar tags that are now available. We are no longer doing small controlled hunts, which the P.S., the department still has the ability to do, and we can see that hunters are very well now versed in how to take cougars without dogs, so they still maintain that capability of doing that, which Mr. Anglin mentioned. They can still do that. But nevertheless, 38,719 tags were sold last year at $11.50 a pop. That made the department over $445,000 in 1 year. Since the passage of Measure 18, the department has accrued almost $3 million in cougar tags due to these changes in strategies. This cougar management plan is being billed as a professional plan. There's a budget in that plan. It is approximately $250,000 budget. The department is spending about $120,000 now to implement that plan with hired employees. They can well afford to pay for professionals to do this job. It is not worth abrogating the good faith of the exemptions that were put in place to protect the public and to protect ranchers when they are in need. And I also want to add one other thing, is that the department has had since 1999 to find a way to deal with this agent status and allow them to assist ranchers or public people in need. They have not done so. They have neither have they spent a penny to hire individuals to assist in that manner. We urge you to vote no on HB 2971.
Hi, I'm Noah Greenwald, a conservation biologist with the Center for Biological Diversity. Thanks for hearing me out. I'm opposed to this bill because I have serious questions about the Cougar Management Plan, and this bill will allow for implementation of that plan. First, the plan is based on several flawed assumptions. One of those assumptions is that flawed and also poorly supported assumptions. One of those assumptions is that cougars' populations are increasing in Oregon and dramatically increasing. And the problem with that is that it's based primarily on cougar-human interactions and also on take and accidental kills of cougar. The problem with basing population estimates on that information is that there's no way to estimate essentially the survey effort, how many people are out there to interact with cougars, or how many incidences, possibilities are there for the cougars to be killed. So essentially there's two equally competitive hypotheses. One is more cougars are being observed and killed because there's more cougars, which is what ODFNW is representing. Two is there's more people in cougar country to observe and interact with cougars. And there's the way that ODFNW has approached that, there's no way to test those alternate hypotheses. And that's because ODFNW has not followed years and years of scientifically credible means for estimating populations. And that's primarily what's called mark recapture, where you mark individuals, you sample, you use consistent sampling methods every year, you look for those marked individuals, you have an ability to get a population estimate that has a confidence interval. They have not followed those methods, which is the accepted method for estimating populations. An example of why this is problematic, a recent study that was published in Journal of Wildlife Management called Cougar Population Dynamics and Viability in the Pacific Northwest. So here's a study that actually radio-collared individuals and estimated their population trend by looking at mortality and reproduction. And it determined that, and this is from northeastern Washington, Idaho, and British Columbia, so an area near to here, it determined that, in fact, cougar populations appeared to be declining quite dramatically. And this was in an area where it was similarly noted that there was more cougar-human interactions, that the cougar population was supposedly increasing. And here it is, when they did a detailed study, they found that, no, the cougar population is not increasing. In fact, it's declining. And in their management implications, these researchers, Lambert et al., they state, our research indicates that wildlife managers should not assume that increasing cougar-human complaints correspond with increasing cougar populations. Indeed, increased complaints may accompany a rapidly declining population, as shown here. So here's, you know, credible research showing that you can't assume that because you have more cougar-human interactions, you have more cougars. But that's, in fact, what ODFNW is doing. And, in fact, that's why they want this bill, so that they can get agents so they can kill cougars, because they believe that there's this abundance of cougars that may or may not exist. So I would ask you not to support this bill until we can get the research, we can do the good science to determine how many cougars we actually have and whether we even need to control cougars. So that's the first flawed assumption. The second flawed assumption is that killing cougars will reduce risk to people. And there's been a lot of work done on this, and in fact, there's quite a bit of scientific information to suggest quite the opposite, that if you remove adult cougars from a population, you may actually increase human conflict because adult cougars
control young cougars. And young males in particular are the ones who disperse more and are more likely to have human interactions. And in fact, the same cougar population dynamics and viability in the Pacific Northwest says this as well. It says, furthermore, increased hunting could actually result in increased cougar complaints because of the younger age structure of the cougar population and the higher proclivity of young animals to encounter humans and cause complaints. So the second assumption is that if they control cougar populations through these agents, that it will reduce risk to humans, and that simply isn't true and isn't proved. So I'd again ask you not to support the bill for that reason. The third thing I would say is that cougar populations, predator-prey interactions are one of the best studied aspects of ecology. There's a long history of studying predator-prey interactions. And it's largely known that predator populations are self-regulating. So as food supply for prey increases, prey correspondingly increases, and then predator populations increase. That cuts down on the prey, and that in itself regulates the predator populations. So there's simply no reason to regulate cougars because they're going to self-regulate on their own with fluctuations in their prey. So that's my conclusion. Please don't support this bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and committee members. My name is James Entz, and I've got a prepared statement I'd like to read. I own and operate a 160-acre ranch surrounded by the Umpqua National Forest in Douglas County. Today I'll speak of the experiences my neighbors at the Cook Ranch and I have had since 1962 running cattle and horses on our collective 1,000 acres within prime cougar habitat from 2,200 feet to 2,700 feet of elevation. To illustrate how deep into cougar habitat we live and work, the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife set up a cougar research area in the National Forest only a few miles from our ranches. The most striking observation I have to share with you is that in spite of our homes being at the center of some of the highest cougar traffic in the state of Oregon, we have not observed any predation on our herd since 1962. Zero. None. During these 45 years, the livestock herds have typically ranged from 30 to 50 head of cattle, typically with 30 cow-calf pairs, 2 to 7 horses, and up to 5 goats, not to mention quite a few dogs and cats. In fact, in all of my years on the Umpqua, I personally have only positively identified a cougar on 2 fleeting occasions when on the Umpqua, as my car headlights caught a glimpse of the creatures dancing off the roadway. These are exceptionally reclusive, magnificent creatures, which have essentially no desire to be seen by or get close to humans. Dozens of our cats and dogs have lived, thrived, and perished without serious encounters with cougar or bear. Admittedly, over the years, we've heard of attacks on neighbors' pets and livestock, but on closer investigation, the cause of these relatively few attacks were simply bad management and husbandry practices, such as staking out goats to mow the lawn and then leaving them staked overnight, or a mighty courageous little lapdog that got blinded from injuries sustained after charging at a cougar which wandered too close to the outbuildings late one night, or the failure to keep foals and calves penned during and immediately after birth, or removing livestock carcasses in a timely manner. It's noteworthy that it appears cougar prefer areas with less human habitation. Moreover, those few documented cougar attacks close to homes or towns have usually been from rogue or sick animals, the remedy for which is provided for under current provisions of Measure 18. To confirm my hunch, I called the Umpqua National Forest District wildlife biologist, Mr. Kevin Sands, on the phone the other day. Kevin shared with me that they aren't really seeing livestock predation. This corroborates our experience as well with regard to both cougar and bear. In short, it's abundantly clear to us that there's no need to institute additional cougar management interventions, particularly through the absurd proposal to deputize the houndsmen as ODF&W agents to run around the woods shooting cougar. These animals are doing just fine as they serve their natural function behind the scenes to cull diseased, old, and genetically inferior deer and elk. The herds upon which they prey benefit from this process. By the way, hunters that I'm acquainted with and who don't run hounds appreciate cougar for these reasons and typically stand united against hound hunting in general as inhumane and unsupporting behavior. At the end of the day, the important reasons that Oregon voters twice affirmed Measure 18 have not changed. HB 2971 is at best yet another end run around the will of the Oregon voters and Measure 18. Thank you for the chance to offer an authentic picture of rural life and ranching pursuits within prime cougar habitat. I'll take any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Michael Moss. I'm a rancher. I own and operate the Siskiyou Crest Goat Dairy down in Jacksonville. Outside of Jacksonville, we have a 64-acre ranch that currently has 80 head of goat, and we have a on-site micro creamery where we produce handmade artisan cheeses. I'm here in opposition to 2971, because much like my other colleagues here, I believe that ODFW's plan and the passing of 2971 will only exacerbate the problem of human-cougar conflict on our farm. I've been ranching goats there for 5 years now, and I've never lost a goat to cougar predation. We protect our herd using good management practices. Despite the fact that I've seen numerous cougars on the farm, we haven't lost an animal yet. Those practices just include penning up our goats at night, having dogs, keeping our dogs and our dog food in at night. It's very common sense stuff that doesn't involve the shoot first, ask questions later management style of the ODFW. I'm also here on behalf of the Siskiyou Sustainable Cooperative, which is a cooperative of 11 different farms, many different farmers, and I have here an open letter signed by many of these farmers on the farms representing, and I believe, all the farms in our co-op that I would like to give you if possible. Can I approach you? Thank you. So my concern is that the ODFW's plan and the passing of 2971 will exacerbate the human-cougar conflict on our farm by removing those established cougars that are hunting their proper prey, the ungulates and smaller mammals, and therefore leaving a vacuum where cougars, younger cougars can come in, and we would have a predation problem on our farm. Because we are a small farm, if we came across a problem like that, it could severely affect the economic viability of our herd. Therefore, we strongly suggest that you vote against 2971. A vote against 2971 is a vote for farmers and ranchers in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Any questions?
Just one question.
Representative Clem.
Do you support the amendments, the Dash 1 amendments that Representative Buckley, I think, drafted and brought in to the bill?
Yes, I support the Dash 1 amendments.
I support the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. Any other questions for this group? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We have a procedural thing where we take those people who traveled more than 100 miles to get here first, because if we reschedule it, there's a better chance for people to come who are closer by. And there are a couple people that way. So first, and we'll go back and forth between those who oppose or not. And we have only about 15 or 20 minutes left today for this hearing. So, Howard A. Martin, and we'll assume you live 100 miles away. Is Howard here?
Probably making his way from an overflow room.
Could be coming. The next person, and this one would be one who is against, is Stuart O'Neill. Thanks, Stuart. Is this our other person? Is this Howard? No. Okay.
No.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Stuart O'Neill. I live and work on a small ranch in southern Oregon, and I'd like to add my voice in opposition to House Bill 2971. To save your time, you've heard many of the same reasons that I share from folks that spoke before. This is a bad bill for farmers and ranchers. It will lead to an increase in conflicts on our farm, and I urge you very strongly to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. ones are probably the
mm-hmm.
girl.
I think so.
Yeah. Tom Powell. These are the people that are over 100 miles away, so we're going to get a few in a row that are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom Powell, Wolf Gulch Farm, Jacksonville, Oregon. I oppose House Bill 2971 for the simple reason that it is unnecessary to attempt to control the cougar population through these means. Farming and ranching is an inherently risky business. Farmers and ranchers recognize this, and there are common sense practices that we can use to protect our families and our herds from cougar attack that certainly does not include the indiscriminate killing of cougars. The state already has a means to take out problem cougars, and this often happens in Jackson and Josephine County. We hear about it all the time. So I urge you to oppose House Bill 2971. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And James McLeod, McLeod. Hope I didn't butcher that too badly. I think it's McLeod. Yeah, should be McLeod. Is it? Yeah.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to present testimony. My name is James McLeod. I have lived and farmed in Williams, Josephine County for almost 20 years. I live in cougar and bear country. Cougars and bears are seen regularly, though infrequently, in my area, which is to be expected for a reasonably intact ecosystem. Many of us in Williams are farmers with livestock and children who have chosen to farm ecologically, so we are concerned with both maintaining healthy predator populations and avoiding conflict with them. We have found that preventive measures are our most functional and most effective tool to reduce the likelihood of conflict with our wild neighbors. Should we feel compelled by circumstances to take more drastic measures, we know we have the option under current law to hunt and kill cougars and bears should they become a danger. We feel that current laws are sufficient to meet our needs and ask that House Bill 2971 be rejected as both redundant and unnecessary, as well as wasteful of taxpayer resources. House Bill 2971 is at best of dubious value to Oregonians. It is not based on any rigorously verified scientific evidence. Although it has been claimed that increased complaints of cougar conflicts equals an increase in cougar populations, this is mistaken an inference for a fact. The actual population of cougars in Oregon has never been scientifically determined. The random hunting with hounds of cougars and the nebulous limits on kill numbers does not look like a plan for responsible management of cougars. For those of us in my community who make their livelihood off the land while attempting to maintain ecological balance with our resident wildlife, House Bill 2971 ends up looking like nothing more than an end run around Measure 18, the voter-approved ban on hounding and baiting, and a SOP for hound hunters. Oregon's voting majority, who have already spoken on this issue and made their will be known, deserve better treatment than this. So also do our top predators. Again, I respectfully urge you to reject House Bill 2971. Thank you.
Thank you. And it looks like the last person that I have on the list that said they were over 100 miles was Marcia Dennison. And then we'll start going back and forth.
Thank you. I just want to say HB 2971 is contrary to the public interest, and our wildlife need to stay in balance naturally, not have some bozo out there shooting them that doesn't know what he's doing. And I want to relinquish my time to Kat Kane, please.
Hello. My name is Kat Kane, or Catherine. I'm the past director of the Northwest Cougar Action Trust in Eugene, and I'll try and be brief. Here's why you can't do this. The primary reason is that you're going to create a public safety threat, as a nice biologist told you. The state may be culpable if people start being attacked by these young transient cougars. We've had 150 years of nobody ever attacked. If somebody is attacked, let's ask the nice man from the Justice Department if we get to sue you for creating a public safety threat, because we're standing here today telling you that how cougar biology works is if you kill off the old cat on the top of the hill, we know that a young cat is going to come, and we know that the young cats are the stupid cats. They're like our teenagers. They're driving around. They don't know where they're going. They'll eat your cat as soon as they'll eat a deer. The old cat, he knew where the deers are. They only need one deer a week. So the state is creating a public safety threat. And we know, you know that you'll have an increase in complaints because you're creating. It's catch-22. And besides this fake complaint system, you have a fake Monte Carlo population guesstimation of 8 zillion cougars. That is an irrationalization to go killing 2,000 more cougars, and that's exactly what you're promulgating. You guys, the ODFW has created its own private terror campaign. Instead of educating the public about how to protect themselves and their livestock, what they've done is try and out and out encourage people. We know this as a fact. The number of complaints has nothing to do with it, but the other major reason is poaching. If you don't know there's a lot of poaching going on, then you need to bring a real officer that's out in the woods in here, because bears are protected by CITES II treaty. That's because every bear population in the world has already been wiped out by the Asian trade. And only bears and cougars are hunted in this fashion, and you can only catch bears and cougars unless you want to put out bait for them. So I'm sorry, this is just another cheap transient ploy that the ODFW tries every 2 years. It never works. We deserve a real state wildlife agency that is protecting our wildlife. We demand it. We don't want to hear any fake excuses. This is obviously the second part of a two-point ply. Run up a fakey cougar killing plan and then implement it by pulling the wool over you guys' eyes. Well, you've heard from everybody, from the city folks to the country folks, and I hope you really listen. We don't want to have to take legal pursuit. And I just want to toss in one more thing. Listen to your own biologist. Mike Wisdom is telling you that cougar and elk, neither one of them like roads. You're wearing the elk out. There's no big old elk to shoot. They don't want to mate with younger elk. When they mate with younger elk, their young doesn't live as long. What we need, my last thing that I'd say, because I know everybody wants to speak, is in order to actually implement the type of cougar biology plan that they brought up the flagpole, you would need large, roadless areas of wilderness where there is no access. And if indeed the ODFW cares about the future and representing the people of this state instead of the 5% of people that buy hunting licenses, as is their dictum to protect all of Oregon's wildlife, then I hope that they will consider making a large roadless area where road closures are protected by people who would protect them. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we had one thing I want to mention. If you brought written testimony and you don't get a chance, because we're only going to be able to take a couple more pieces of testimony, please leave it with our assistant, Brian, over here, and we will get it to all of the committee members so they can read it. The first person on the list, because now we've gone over all the people over 100, was Jane Miller.
Thank you so very much for letting me be here and share with you. I will try and be very quick. My name is Jane Miller. I represent Mill Creek Watershed Council and Oregon Cougar Action Team. I'm a cattle rancher's daughter. I grew up in 7,000 acres here in Oregon and a 245-acre sheep ranch. The cattle ranch was in Klamath Falls. And I currently ranch. I've been ranching for 50 years. But I am opposed to this bill. Cougars are extinct in 36 states of the Union. That's half of the United States. They're extinct as a result of overhunting, poor science, mismanagement of cougar and supporting wildlife, countless acres lost per day to development, fragmentation, and untold degradations. They're extinct. And we have no guarantee this won't happen in Oregon, especially with our global warming issues. Oregon has no current plan, including this bill, 2971, that is based on fact or science or sustainability. And Oregon's infamous cougar management plan has been documented in the Smithsonian Magazine and also in Dr. Jane Goodall's book, The Ten Trusts, both of which I have here. as being a very poor plan, which is an embarrassment to Oregonians who voted twice not to use dogs or bait for cougar here in Oregon. All numbers regarding how many cougar we have here in Oregon are based on guesses and information from hunters who kill them. There is no science or reliable tracking information. Cougars are killing undamaged cougars in record numbers and labeling them as damaged cougars simply because they believe there's a potential in the future that these cougars could cause damage. This kind of mislabeling affects our science program, including some of the stories that are spun around these cougars, affects the reliability of a sound science program. Oregon's Cougar Management Plan and the science behind it appear to have little to add to the preservation and sustainability of Oregon's cougars and Oregon's health, safety, and welfare, or spending our state money wisely. Oregon State University's recent study concerning cougars has determined that the cougar is a keystone species, keeping our watersheds, riparian areas, wetlands, forests, soils, and other valuable wildlife and biodiversities healthy and viable. Without the cougar, Oregonians would be spending far more tax dollars dealing with water quality issues, erosion, wildlife depreciation, lost biodiversities, then Bill 2971 would save them. What with global warming and poor out-of-balance science management program behind this bill, Bill 2971 risks more habitat and plant extinction than just the possibility of Oregon's cougar. Using dogs to hunt cougar and kill cougar is not only inhumane and unnecessary, but does not contribute to the health, safety, or welfare of Oregonians. And as Ron Anglin stated, imagine trying to get your dog to do something. 500,000 Americans each year are disfigured by pet or trained dogs. Up to 30 Americans die from these attacks each year. In the last 100 years, cougars have killed 20 Americans, two of which died from rabies, and 71 others were attacked and survived. Now, on our cattle ranches and our current farm, we've had cougar. We've not lost any livestock. We've not been attacked by the cougar. And however, we lost 50 head of sheep to hound dogs. I couldn't believe how fast it happened, and I witnessed it. I was 16 years old. All 50 head of my sheep were killed by hound dogs. Now, I have from Sarah Wiedenhoff. She established Bill Number 2345. She writes in opposition to Bill 2971. She sent me a letter and asked me to read it to you. Honorable Chair and Committee Members, my husband and I have been raising sheep on a small ranch southeast of Coos Bay for the past 25 years. Our property is backed by timberland of substantial size. And all these years, the only damage we have had from the timberland inhabitants is the damage to fences by elk. Although there have been reports of cougar being seen by hunters in this timberland, we have never had any problem on our property. On the other hand, we have seldom, maybe 3 years in the past 25, gone through a summer or spring without domestic dogs coming into our fields and killing our sheep, sometimes just 100 feet from our home. There is the summer when the pack of dogs chased a young buck out of the timberlands and into our pasture. The deer had been run to death. It collapsed in our pasture and died. We heard the dogs in the hills, but they didn't arrive to our property until 3 days later and were chasing our sheep. In short, my negative experiences have not been with the wildlife, such as the cougar, as much as they have been with our highly revered domestic pets, otherwise known as the dog. Now, I live in this community, and I've made my living successfully in this community. My brother was Anthony Flagg, president of Pendleton Flour Mills. We are vested here in Oregon, and I want to see Oregonians be safe. Whenever there is anger or fear, there's a lack of education, which is why I started Oregon Cougar Action Team. I go around Oregon giving presentations to teach people how to coexist fear-free with cougars and stay safe with them, protect their livestock, their family, pets, and their children, and the species of cougar. So why three cougar bills that include 2791 for a cougar issue of public safety and livestock damage issues we do not have with cougars, as we do in comparison to dogs, and only one dog bill, 2345, addressing a small portion of damage for an issue of statewide magnitude public safety and livestock loss and financial loss. This out of proportion. I believe Oregonians can do better. We don't want to be represented in the magazines anymore as having the poor Oregon Cougar plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And now we'll go down the list of someone who has indicated a pro, Warren Arney, and I guess Steve Gafford. Take
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here today representing the Wildlife Society. I have with me chairman of our legislative committee, Warren Haney, who's a wildlife biologist. Our organization is the Professional Association of Wildlife Biologists in the state of Oregon. I want to make one just quick comment before Mr. Haney testifies, and that is I urge you to read the bill. The bill does not have anything to do with what will happen. The bill simply has to do with who will do it. If the bill passes, agents will do it. If the bill fails, ODF&W personnel will do it. The bill will not change what happens. So all the people who are concerned about how we got to treat cougars, that is a different issue. There's lots of difference on that, opinion on that, but that's not the subject of today's discussion.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Warren Haney, and I'm here, as Stephen said, on behalf of my professional society, the Oregon Chapter of the Wildlife Society. We represent over 300 wildlife professionals here in Oregon, and one of our chapter's goals is to promote the application of sound science when we're making resource management decisions, and that's where I'd like to focus my comments. I am a professionally certified wildlife ecologist with over 45 years' experience here in Oregon, and I'm familiar with the complexities and challenges of wildlife management and research. And I can assure you that there are a lot more complexities and challenges when you're dealing with a secretive and intelligent species such as cougar. The use of trained hounds is generally acknowledged by wildlife scientists as the most efficient and selective means for locating and capturing black bear and cougar for various management and research activities. For example, there was a mention of using mark recovery. It's a good research tool. That's where you capture an animal, you put a mark on him, usually a radio collar, and then you track that animal or recapture that animal later or reobserve that animal later. The most effective and selective way of capturing the animal you need for that purpose is the use, when you're dealing with cougars and bear, is the use of hounds handled by an experienced hound handler. Other forms of capture for management or research are less efficient and unselective. There's things like box traps, nooses. These do not select the animal. You've got to put a lot of effort into even getting one capture, and frequently that capture is not the animal that you want to target for your research purposes or your management purposes. I've been assured by reading this legislation and by discussing this with Department of Fish and Wildlife staff that there is no intent to override the ban, the voter-approved ban, on using hounds for hunting on a recreational basis. The intent is to make it possible for Department of Fish and Wildlife to use an effective and selective capture tool for purposes of management and research. We appreciate this opportunity to provide some science-based information and add that to this discussion, and we'll be able to provide other information on this topic if it is needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Oh, one question. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, have you seen the Dash 1 amendments?
No, I have not seen the Dash 1 amendment.
I'd like to hear what your opinion on the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments when you get a chance.
Okay, we can do that.
I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
Okay, thank you. And again, we are scheduled till 5. It's a little bit after, and I have another meeting I have to go to for my next sixth hour of hearings all day today. And so what we will do is we will keep the list. When we schedule, we'll make sure there's at least 2 days' notice so people will know what's going on if this comes up next. If you have written testimony, please leave it here so that we will get it. It will be distributed to all of the people. I appreciate all of you being here, and with that, we'll close our hearing on, is that 3481? 2971, there it is. And we will, any questions, anything else? We'll close our meeting of the Ag Natural Resources. Thanks.